cash, credit, or debit? What's in your pocket? And what do you plan on using on Black Friday or Small Business Saturday? And don't forget about Cyber Monday. We will get some advice on this edition of On Your Money. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 22nd. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley is here, and he will share some information and advice on your money. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So, did you get all your holiday shopping finished yet?
For 2010, I just kind of sealed the deal on that one, and right. Pretty soon I'm going to start with 2011 here. When is the holidays?
I know that they've been asking me to buy in the stores since about October 1st or so. But
I feel like they're telling me to buy. They're not asking anymore. They're saying, "Please, come on, just buy something now."
Yeah, they're playing the chestnuts roasting on an open fire and all that stuff. But anyway, as I'm sure everybody has noticed, there's a lot of holiday shopping happening, and I'm wondering if I should be using cash, credit, or debit, Kevin. You say our choice of payment options might be dictated by forces we've never considered.
That's correct. A new study published in the Journal of Consumer Research says using a credit card can cloud your intellect and your judgment. A professor from the University of Kansas found that subjects who made purchases with credit cards, first of all, were much more likely to buy fun things with credit cards and pay cash for boring things. More interestingly, he found that people who buy things with credit cards, after they've paid for it with a credit card, they tend to exaggerate the benefits of the item that they've purchased, minimize the costs and the downside, and they are less able to remember the price of the item they purchased with a credit card than people who were purchasing items with cash. This is frightening enough for some people, but it could get even worse with technology that's right around the corner and in some cases even here, where you can basically wave your smartphone at a terminal when you're making a purchase, press a button, and the payment is transmitted. So you don't even have to go through the whole, you know, slide your card, enter the secret number on the back and all that. So you just hold your phone at it, press a button, and you're done.
You'll buy really fun things with your smartphone, then, I guess.
Life will be great.
Right? My goodness. So should I use a debit card instead of a credit card then?
It only really for convenience and definitely not for spending, because you're still just, I mean, yes, I suppose in your mind you're aware that money is being pulled out of your checking or savings account with a debit card versus borrowing it by using a credit card. But still, the same features and issues apply to debit in that you're just swiping a piece of plastic and you're not handing over cash. So if you do find yourself having a problem with spending and you do feel that high of sliding the plastic through or entering your digits, you might want to just use cash instead.
But boy, Kevin, cash isn't all that convenient, is it?
No, it's not. And in fact, it's almost to the point where if you use cash now, people actually look askance at you, like, "Oh, what's he got to hide here? I mean, you know, if he's forking over cash, what's the matter? Aren't you, you know, are you a drug dealer, or what's? Why are you paying for cash?" But that's the point, that it's less convenient. So you're more likely to feel pain by spending cash than you are by using plastic. So you're less likely to spend. Another trick, if you're looking to limit your spending and during this holiday season, is something that was also published by the Journal of Consumer Research, a little piece on the denomination effect, which found that people who carry cash in the form of big bills like 20s, 50s, and 100s are much less likely to spend those because they don't like to break the bills than people who carry ones and fives and tens around. So, you know, if you're really going to have a hard time with spending, get yourself, you know, one of those Chester A. Arthur $1,000 bills or something and just put that in your wallet and probably go the whole holiday season without spending a single penny.
I didn't know there was a $1,000 bill. Anyway, so is there any point at all in using credit cards?
Well, yeah, actually, much more so than with debit cards, and especially for people who can handle them responsibly. It's a great idea to use a credit card to buy things if you can avoid paying interest and you can pay the bill off right away. First of all, you get your cash back rewards, which can be 1% to 2% of the purchase. We spoke last week about the extra warranty coverage that some credit cards offer, so check your card issuer and see if it provides an extended warranty above and beyond the manufacturer's warranty of the item you're purchasing. Also, many credit cards, when you buy something with a credit card, it's much easier to dispute the charges later on if something goes wrong, in that the credit card company will almost serve as an advocate for you rather than a debit card. The money's just yanked out of your checking or savings account. And finally, you get more protection from theft with credit cards than you do with debit cards. Remember, this is just easy access to your checking account, and it's time sensitive. So if your debit card information is stolen, the money's drawn out, you have a very narrow window to report that loss before you're liable for everything that's in the debit card. So generally, if you can exercise self-control, only charge what you can afford to pay off at the end of the month, it's better to use credit cards than any other type of currency.
All right. But if you do, again, have that issue with overspending on your credit card, it sounds like come up with some sort of gift list and have an idea of how much you're going to be spending in cash and have that amount of cash on you. That's the safest thing.
You know, there are times when I'll go in the supermarket and for whatever reason, I don't have a debit card with me. I just have cash. And it's amazing how much more price conscious I become, even a so-called expert like myself, when I just know that, hey, I've got two 20s in my pocket. I can only spend $40. And I'm adding this up in my head. And it's almost a point of anxiety while the clerk is ringing everything up to say, okay, I want to make sure I got enough. Okay, $36.53. Great, I got that. So if people are having trouble with the amount of money that they think they're spending and would like to control it, carrying cash for your allotted budget is the best way to control what you spend.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234. We have a line open for you. Or you can email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And it is time for the On Your Money email bag, where Sophie says, I have recently changed employers, and my new employer doesn't let me participate in their 401k plan until a year later. I had a 401k plan with my prior employer. How can I invest more in my retirement pre-tax for this year, Kevin?
Well, it's common that many larger employers especially do not give new employees access to the plan, in part because they want to see if the person is going to stick around, and they don't want to do a lot of paperwork for someone who doesn't work out right away. But there are really only a few reasons that not being able to contribute to an at-work plan should be an issue. First of all, one of the advantages of an at-work plan is it's forced savings, meaning that money is usually deducted from your paycheck on an ongoing basis, and you don't have to remember to transfer it over, and you really don't miss it as much as when you have to actually write a check out for the deposit. Many employers, about two-thirds of larger employers, have some kind of match in place that's yours the minute it goes into your account in most cases. So you're missing out on that if you're not contributing to your employer's plan. There are greater contribution limits, meaning you can put more money into a 401k or a 403b than you can other IRAs. But otherwise, generally an IRA is okay, and in many cases it may be better. You get more control over the money and you get easier access. Once you put money into an employer plan, depending on the regulations regarding the plan, it's very difficult to get the money out. In some cases, you can't get it out in most circumstances. An IRA, you can always pull the money out. Yes, you pay taxes, and yes, you'll probably pay a penalty if it's not for a sanctioned use, but at least it's your money and it's easier to get access to it.
All right. Tell us more about that. How can she use the IRA instead of a 401k?
If she goes to any financial institution like a bank or a credit union or an insurance agency, an investment firm, or if she wants to do it herself with a little bit of guidance, but usually a lower cost, she can go to a place like Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard. TIA Cref is another one that provides these services. Just go online and you can open an IRA either with the help of a customer service representative, or you can fill out a form online. And thousands of people do this every day, and it's just as safe as any other method.
How much can she put in or deposit into an IRA?
Depending on the type of account, usually she can put in the lesser of her earnings or $5,000 and lesser of her earnings or $6,000 if she's over 50. And if Sophie's married, she can also open up an IRA on behalf of her spouse, even if her spouse is not working outside the home, and contribute a similar amount. The nice thing about this, it can be done now if she wants to. She can have, like, say, $250 a month deducted from her checking account and have it go automatically into her IRA. Or if she's disciplined, she can set the money aside now and then contribute for a 2011 IRA by April 15th of next year when she files her taxes. So she, just because she doesn't qualify for the plan right now in a 401k, it doesn't mean she has to be contributing now to that IRA. She can actually wait until, you know, another, what, 5 months before she has to actually contribute to it.
If you would like a question considered for the email bag segment of the program, you can send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call us right now if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dollar bill, it's all about the dollar bill.
Well, you know, coming up on Your Money, we're going to talk about cold, hard cash and talk about winter weather and our money. That's coming up on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is our guest, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tim in Wisconsin Rapids is with us first. Hello, Tim.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. One of the unintended outcomes of the loss of our bargaining rights as teachers, and I'm a retired teacher, was that our school board took away our long-term care coverage, which we had been paying $86 a month for the last 11 years. And we're left with rather a hard decision right now. We can continue coverage in a different company for about $440 a month for my wife and myself, or we could buy out the coverage for our current company for something over $40,000 in a one-time lifetime payout. I wonder if Kevin has any thoughts about that in terms of what's the best route. The $40,000 sounds an awful lot like, you know, a very heavy bet on red 17 on a roulette wheel, and yet the other one is not much less money over time. That would be the same $40,000 over about 8.5 years, according to my calculations. And then I'd like to have a comment on the long-term care partnership program in the state of Wisconsin. My financial guy mentioned this last week, and it was totally unknown to me what the benefits of this program would be. And if we could have some comments on that, that might be a great sales tool for long-term care salesmen.
It is, Tim, and let's get to that first, because the partnership program is basically a provision in the state of Wisconsin and many other states where if a person buys a policy designated as a partnership policy, in most cases what happens is, if let's say the policy pays out a total of $4,000 a month over let's say 5 years, so that's $240,000, 60 months times $4,000 a month. A partnership policy provision allows the family to keep that $240,000 amount assets in place before qualifying for public assistance. So it's an extra incentive for people to say, look, this isn't going to be just about, you know, you giving up all of your money in short-term payments and then you still have to spend down. It's also about preserving some money that you might have now and still being able to qualify for public assistance. It's a really great deal. Many policies have it. As a matter of fact, if you're looking for this and you don't have a partnership policy and you plan on living in Wisconsin, you're doing something wrong. So make sure you ask for that. Tim, did you check around for some other policy options other than the one that charges you $400 and some a month?
Oh, I sure did. This is one of the better policies, actually. That would give comparable coverage to the original company. It's really really hard to compare these things because sometimes they state benefits in terms of benefits per day after the first 25%, and the others are benefits per month. It's really apples and oranges, but something comparable would cost us about $440 a month.
Well, and that might say more to just how good the policy was that you had before versus what the policy actually cost, because unless you or your wife have some big red flag from a health history, most people are able to get decent long-term care insurance for somewhere in the range of $150 to $200 a month at the most, and usually it's quite a bit less expensive than that. So maybe rather than trying to duplicate the policy that you used to have, I'd rather have you go with a policy that is more affordable, because most people, first of all, don't want to use a long-term care policy. People hate buying this stuff. They'd rather buy life insurance, which, as we've established, the only way anyone gets any money on that is when you die. But people just do not like buying long-term care insurance because they have this vision that they just want to die in their sleep, in their bed at home when they're 85 years old or 90. And if it happens like that, all the money that you would have paid into the long-term care insurance company is supposedly wasted. That's the wrong way to look at that. No one at the end of this year, at the end of December, says, we paid all that money in on our homeowners insurance premiums and our house never burned down. This is really a waste. We're never going to do this again. You need to look at long-term care insurance, first of all, in that mode that you're protecting from an event happening that you don't want to happen but could. Second of all, you need to look at it on a short-term basis, which is why I highly recommend that you stay away from that big lump sum buyout, because you don't know what your needs will be in the future. You don't know what the world will look like in the future, and you don't even know if the company will be in business, quite frankly, when you need that. And if you've given them all of your money, it's going to be very difficult to get that back out. So if you are going to get the policy, and I do recommend people with assets between a couple $100,000 and a couple $1 million, look at long-term care insurance. If you're going to get it, I'd much rather have you get a lesser policy than the one you've been looking at and pay it as you go rather than paying that big lump sum and seeing all that money lost.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Tim, for the call. Now we go to Marcy in Eau Claire. Hello, Marcy.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regards, Kevin, to what you were talking about regarding debit cards versus credit cards. I was one of those people in the generation that you always wrote checks, and I finally got a debit card, and I find it to be very convenient. I was wondering, what about the possibility of, let's say I owe $120 on my credit card this month, and I pay in, because I know it's Christmas, $520, and then I have a balance in my credit card of $400 that I can use similar to a debit card. Is that stupid or what?
It's not stupid, and I'm sure some people are, after you got done with that, Marcy, said, that's stupid. I don't think so. And the reason being is that money, and especially the use of money and spending and saving, is not just a mental intellect and discipline. It's governed more by your heart and your gut and other parts of your body. And so playing these little games, if it works for you, it works. And as long as there's no substantial risk or cost to doing it, if that allows you to build that up, I'd say go right ahead and do it. Now, the issue, and you have to check with your credit card company, is to say, if I do send you way too much money, what's going to happen to it? Are you going to allow me to draw on it in the form of charges, or are you going to freeze it and then try to keep sending me a check? Because some of these companies have laws and regulations about how they handle basically a surplus into what's supposed to be a debt account. So check with the credit card company and ask them if I do choose to do this, what will happen to my account, and will I still be able to use the card as I normally do and draw down that? But no, I do not think it's stupid. If it works for you and helps you stick to the budget, which is a very difficult thing to do in these times, and especially at this time of the year, please, please, please go ahead and do it, and actually let us know what you come up with.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Marcy, you're very smart. Thanks very much for the call. I didn't think that stupid, but I thought, huh, I never thought of that.
No, we've been told we're not supposed to call the caller stupid even when we do think it. So
Rob yells at me if I do that. So
he's stupid.
Now, our next caller is, and I'm going to maybe be stupid and mispronounce this, Pushpa in Onalaska.
Hi. This is Pushpa Sudhakar, and thanks for taking my call. I enjoy your show very much, especially the sense of humor from Kevin.
Yes, he is funny.
Okay, Pushpa, you have the rest of the hour for anything you want to talk about.
I listen to you every Tuesday, and I enjoy the show on my drive to work. It's more of a curiosity question. The question I have is, you know, we pay off the credit card every month within 30 days. So technically, this credit card company is loaning us that much money free. How do they make money? I know they may probably make money off of interest, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Just a curiosity.
That's a great question, just because to wondering what are they doing? And the answer is they make money in several different ways, even when you do pay off the balance. One is with annual fees that you pay to keep the card open. The other one is from if they charge the merchant any fees to make the transaction. And finally, it's just a bet on their part. A lot of people who do pay their bills off every single month are surprised that they're either denied credit or their credit scores aren't as strong as they would feel, because they I'm a great risk. You say, well, you might be a great risk, but you're not profitable for the credit card issuer. So there's a delicate middle ground there between the people who are profitable and still pay their bills off. And you sound to be far over to the spectrum of where you're a great credit risk, but you are not very profitable for the credit card company. They much prefer people who carry a balance and then make the minimum payment for it. And they can kind of just, you know, keep this great relationship going where you just pay interest every single month and don't pay the principal. And that's one of the reasons the credit card companies have to charge, you know, 18% interest is, yes, they make a lot of money off of that rate, but a lot of people default on credit cards, and a lot of people use the service and don't pay any interest or don't pay any fees. So the reason they generally have to charge higher interest rates is because many people are, I mean, for lack of a better word, free riders on the system, and then many people are drawing from the system by charging it up and then not paying the debit off. So that percentage, while it seems egregious to us, it's there for a reason. And if people could make money with issuing credit cards that only charge 8 or 9%, they would have done it a long time ago, but they can't generally, so they don't.
Thanks very much for the call, Pushpa. Here's a related email. Marilyn in Reeseville called, and I guess she didn't email, she called, and she wanted to say, as a small business owner, credit cards cost them 5% every time a credit card is used. She says she loves it when people pay in cash or check. So there's a retailer who says she is paying that fee to a credit card company for every time a credit card is used.
Yeah, and that's true. If you want to help out, you know, you talked about shop local or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you really want to help out a merchant, please hand that small business owner cash, because it's so much easier for them. And many of these small businesses, their margins of profits are very, very small. And those few percentage points that might not seem, oh, you know, it's 0.5%, 2%, 5%, whatever. What difference does it make? I'll tell you what, it makes a huge difference for a small business owner. So if you really want to help a small business owner out, pay cash.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, and if you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment, but it's time now for the Smart Assets part of the program. And Kevin, many worried workers could get a big surprise from some of their retirement plan investment options, even if they think those are safe investments. How so?
Well, if people aren't worried right now, it's usually for two reasons. Either they're not paying attention, or they have nothing to lose, and quite frankly, they have bigger problems than what happens to their retirement savings. Every single day, almost to every single hour, we are getting a new story from some country in Europe that is at a risk because the interest rates on their sovereign debt, the debt that the governments issue, is rising because people are worried that they're not going to be able to pay it off, or they're worried about losing their rating, or there's political instability. volatility. And quite frankly, we're either in a recession right now and it's not being called as such yet, or we're headed into one. Usually a declining economy while oil's hitting $100 a barrel almost always leads to some form of recession. So many people who are saving money in their at-work 401ks or 403bs or TSAs, they're putting money into bond funds, money market funds, and stable value funds in an effort to try to reduce volatility, which so far has worked, and also to reduce risk to that money. But in many of those types of investment options, there's way more downside than there is upside, and they should be very concerned about having money in there under false pretenses.
Because they are risky, even though we think they're not?
Yeah, what the reason being is that many of these investments, the fact that they are such a solution to, you know, lack of volatility or to a high degree of volatility, and people don't want to see the money flying around in the stock market, they've become so popular that they've driven up the price of the investment. We're almost in a safe money bubble. Very low yields on safe money right now, 1-2% on treasury bonds, and many of these companies have expenses to manage that particular fund or money market. Running a fund can run anywhere from 0.5% to 1% of the assets per year. Well, if you're only earning 1% on the money and it's costing your business 0.5% to 1% to manage that particular account, there's no profit to it for either you or the investor. So the funds have a choice. They can either lose money, which they can only do for so long, or take more risk to try to earn the difference between what they can earn on the money and the expenses of managing the fund. And with these European issues, you know, a butterfly in Greece flaps his wings and all of a sudden the markets lock up. This can happen very quickly, and it can be very damaging for people who are counting on that money being there. And worse yet, if this either causes a recession or we were going to go into one anyway, many of these safe and investment options are discovered to be not so safe because they can't pay off the interest at the high rate they were originally issued.
All right, Kevin, you've shattered my blissful ignorance. what if you don't have safer options in a retirement plan? What can we do to stay safe?
Well, that is one of our jobs here, I think, is to afflict the afflicted. Isn't that,
right.
Is that the way that
Something
works?
Something like okay. that.
Right. Most people don't have any safer options in their retirement plan. This is one of the things that we alluded to earlier with Sophie. She might want to use an IRA instead, and especially if you are not contributing the over $5,000 or $6,000 a year to your at-work plan, or you don't have a match, you might want to use an IRA because you can buy certificates of deposit with that, which still have some risks, but are way safer than any other investment out there. They have a very low yield, but if you get one that has a 1-2% return and a very small penalty for early withdrawal, you're not going to make any money, but you're not going to lose much either.
So what if you have some money in savings to go along with the money in your 401k?
You might want to move the money that's in your 401k to actual equities because, yes, there is a lot more risk to that, but there's also a lot more potential reward, especially over the long term. If you focus on, you know, blue chip companies, stocks that pay dividends and utilities, yes, those things can still move up and down 20-30% in a bad or good year. But at least then you've got some, you know, regular additions going into there, so you're buying more systematically at lower prices. And then the money that you have, hopefully, that's outside of your at-work retirement plan, use that to put in the banks that are FDIC insured or credit unions and buy CDs or buy those Series I savings bonds, which we love.
1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question for Kevin. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we'll take a call now from Rick in Monona. Hello, Rick.
Good morning. My question is, I have two kids that are both minors, 14 and 16. And by the time they graduate, I'm putting money away for them in a savings account. And by the time they graduate, they're going to have a substantial amount of money. I'm just wondering if there's some kind of way that when they turn 18 that I can still have some authority over how they withdraw the money. My fear is that suddenly they'll come in, they'll turn 18, and I know one of them would probably go out and buy a Maserati with the money.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I like that.
Well, plus, now that we're as old as we are and we know what we know about life, I might say, hey, you're going to be old and the Maserati isn't even going to interest you when you're middle aged. So you look like a jerk driving one if you're over a certain age. So now that you're in your teenage years, go get that Maserati. That's just fine. And so you want to know how you can control that money, basically, even though they've gotten to an age where technically they have control over the account. Right, Rick?
You nailed it.
Okay, here's the problem with that, and it's a good lesson for other people listening out there who want to save money for their children and do the right thing. And I wrote a book that was fairly successful several years ago called Make Your Kid a Millionaire. So I believe in investing for children. I just don't believe in giving the money to children. I mm-hmm. like them to benefit from it when they're adults and hopefully old enough to make the right decisions. So there are a couple different options you have here. One is that, first of all, don't tell them about the accounts. If they don't know about it, from a legal aspect, it's still their money. They can get it at it whenever they want. But you have a difficult time convincing them that they can't have at it if they already know about it. Second of all, you can talk to them, and in theory, they can say, okay, Dad, we know you set these accounts up for us, but we want to transfer the money back into your name or to some kind of a trust so that we don't have access to it. If they're that willing to make that step, which is a big step, you can probably give them the money anyway because they're probably so responsible and farsighted that they'll handle it appropriately. The third way is probably the easiest way, where you're required to spend that money, Rick, on items that benefit those kids. And it has to generally be above and beyond the basic expenses. You know, you can't say, well, you know, here's your oatmeal for breakfast, and I'm taking a dollar out of your Utma account. You have to spend it on, you know, private school tuition, a car, a computer. College definitely counts for that, but I would try to use it up in whatever you possibly can as soon as you possibly can so that once they turn the age of majority, they don't have that temptation to go after it. The other thing that you can do, are they working right now or not?
No. Uh-uh.
Okay. Is there any chance that they will be working?
Yeah, one of them is 16 and he'll probably be working this summer.
Okay, one move that doesn't necessarily help you in the issue of control, but it's a nice idea for financial aid purposes, is to take some of that money and put it into a Roth IRA for the kid based on his earnings to the extent that he has earnings. If he makes $3,000, you can slide $3,000 over into a Roth IRA for him. It's still an UTMA, it's owned by him, but at least $3,000 set aside for retirement is money that's going to be sheltered from the financial aid process to a great degree. Plus, it's, you know, it could be worth $150,000 by the time he actually turns 60 or 65. But I would be very cautious about going through this. Many people treat these accounts lightly, and they really are. If they're using the kid's Social Security number on this account, it is really the kid's money. And I've seen a couple very nasty incidences where, you know, kids have actually taken their parents to court because the parents say, I'm not giving you this money no matter what happens for it. The nice thing about that case, at least the money's eaten up by legal fees, and so the kids can't spend it frivolously.
Can I ask one more question? What about a trust? Going to a lawyer and getting a trust drawn up?
You can do that. It's a lot of work because technically, again, it's the kid's money, and I suppose there's a case where you could put language in there and say that the reason I'm doing this is because I want to benefit the kid and protect the kid from himself or herself, but it's the kid's money, so really the kid has to agree to do it. And I've actually read something a long time ago where there was a case that someone did exactly what you were trying to do, and the court said, well, the kid couldn't make the decision to give you the authority to do that because he or she wasn't the age of majority. So it's a legal nightmare. And people who are saving for kids for college or for whatever are way better off setting up some kind of trust or using those EdVest college savings account we've talked about, because then the parent or grandparent or whomever keeps total control over the money but just sets up the kid as the beneficiary.
Good luck to you, Rick. And speaking of EdVest, or maybe an alternative to EdVest, is Donna in Burlington. Hello, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I have been saving in an EdVest account for my son since he was about 4 months old, and he's almost 13. And my concern is everything I hear is that the economy is not really going to be recovering for another 10 years. So I've been holding back on contributing any more money to the EdVest because it just looks like we keep losing it. And I was wondering if there was a safer way of investing the money since he's only got 5 years left for college.
Sure, that's a good point, Donna, because you know, unlike saving for retirement, where many people not only have decades before they need the money, but the process of drawing the money out typically takes, hopefully, decades. Saving for college, you usually have just a few years, and then it's just a matter of months sometimes before the money is exhausted when it's actually needed. So it's a legitimate concern. The problem is there are no safe investments out there that pay you a rate of return that will do anything close to keeping up with the cost of college, the rising cost of college. So you have a couple different choices. You can either bite the bullet and say, okay, we'll accept the fluctuation up and down in the return for hoping to beat the cost of college, or we're going to accept that we're going to buy a five-year CD or six-year CD, and we're only going to get 2 or 3% on it, but at least we know that we're not going to lose the money and the money's going to be there. And that's a choice that all investors have, but especially people in your situation. I would say, you know, you might want to make that fund a little more conservative. They have some of those age-based allocations in the Edvest account, and try to get it so it's becoming more conservative as your son gets closer to becoming 18. At least that takes some of the thought process out of that and some of the hassle of trying to manage the money yourself.
Good luck, Donna. Thanks very much for the call. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment, and we will also talk about winter driving costs as On Your Money continues here on the Ideas Network. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Greenback paper bill. Yes, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
We are talking about your money and the cost of winter driving during this segment of Shop Around here on Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are getting our first tastes of winter in parts of the state anyway, which means it's good to spend a little money to make it safer when you're out on the road. Kevin, have you had some slips and slides yet winter driving?
I'm becoming old now because my fear over ice and sleet out on the highways is not relegated to driving. It's relegated to just walking to my vehicle now. So I'm this close to just a broken hip laying me up in a nursing home for several months. It's sad.
I thought you were also going to say I'm more frightened of winter driving as I get older. I mean,
this is also true. Yes. I want these kids off of my lawn, and I want it to stop sleeting and snowing. Those are the only two things that I ask right now.
Yeah,
they're my kids. I'm telling to get off my lawn too.
Yes.
That makes no sense.
I know.
Yeah, it was amazing the way the accidents started piling up just an hour after this first little dusting of ice and snow. And you know, for a minute there, we forgot we were Wisconsinites and started driving like people from Georgia and Texas the minute they get a little bit of precipitation. Mm-hmm. But with the holidays coming up in the next 6 weeks, you got tighter times economically and tighter time constraints. We don't have a lot of time to do this. People are more likely to delay the proper maintenance of their vehicles, but spending a few dollars on it now can save lots of money and lots of trouble later, keeping you from getting stranded or causing some kind of accident or worse. This is a good idea for yourself, but it's a great practical gift that if you give it to someone who's especially a younger teenager or an adult who probably isn't spending money on these things, they'll roll their eyes, but you can feel good knowing you spent money on helping keep them safe.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Where would you start?
Bring the vehicle into a service station. Many enterprising outfits right now have a winterization package special. Definitely check the battery. Make sure it's going to start even in the coldest of weather, the fluid levels. Get the brakes checked. Make sure that the pads are in good shape and they're very operable. Also, and this is something we always forget about, it's very valuable, and you only find out about it until it's too late. Get new windshield wipers.
Mm-hmm.
And have the fluid replaced as well, because if even when the wipers work to 90%, there's always a streak that, of course, always works.
It's right at eye level.
Just your eye level. Yes. I don't know how the wiper manufacturers do that, where they wear out just at eye level for it. You know, you might spend maybe $50 to $100 on getting all of this little maintenance done, but it's well worth it.
And then what?
Go to your tires. Again, this is another thing that's no fun to spend money on new tires, but it's a great investment as well. And at the very minimum, go and reinflate the tires, because when it just turned cold like this, many times tires will lose 10% of their air or more, and they lose their traction. It's way worse gas mileage, so at least inflate them. But better off yet, if you can't remember the last time you bought new tires, go get new ones. It's really just a matter of time. It's not like, you know, this is an extra expense. The longer you drive the car, the more likely you are going to be replacing the tires, and maybe so you buy one extra set of tires over the life of the car. It's such a small investment. You're basically delaying the inevitable by not buying it. So you're going to be a little shocked at the sticker price of tires. They are over $100 a piece for most decent ones. But, all you need to do is slide through one stop sign as traffic is coming, and all of a sudden that $400 or $500 you might spend is a pretty small price to pay. And finally, two things. And I mentioned getting old. This is something that now that I'm in middle age, I've actually learned and adopted. Go slow. And more importantly, don't go. Don't get caught up in the whole, oh, we have to be there. You know, Uncle Bob will get upset if we don't make it for it. Just don't go. You know, worst case scenario, stay home, stay safe, and get a Skype account, and you can get the same level of insults and hostility from your family online that you could in person, and everybody will be a little bit safer.
Yeah, right. Safer and less stress. And it's funny, Kevin. I did get new tires, so I've got one thing done here, but I need to get a new windshield wiper. I noticed on Saturday night coming back from the Fox River Valley to Madison, where some parts of the state were getting snow, it was raining. And that's when my windshield wiper at eye level was not clearing away the...
Yeah, that's bad enough. So then you get the new option where you get either get the dog out the side of the car driving, which of course is always safe to have your head stuck out in traffic, or you get a little bit of a knowledge of what it was like to be a tank driver in World War II, where you get that tiny little eye slot that's the only thing you can clean off, and that's what you're trying to drive at 60 miles an hour with several thousand pound of steel hurtling down the highway here. But no, this should be fine. I can see great.
We will put that on the list. And time for some more questions for Kevin. We have a Facebook question. Beverly writes, hi, Joy and Kevin. My husband and I need a new car. I'm retired and my husband is retiring in May. I want to pay $20,000 cash plus trade-in for the car, but my husband thinks we should finance at 1.9%. I hate monthly payments and I'm not making any interest on my money anyway. Help?
If this is an issue where that $20,000 is a decent portion of their net worth, they should definitely borrow, especially at 1.9%, and especially if they go back to the car dealership and say, is there any discount for paying cash versus this subsidized loan rate? Mm-hmm. If there's not, she should definitely finance. She can buy a CD that pays 2.5% from Discover Bank for 10 years with a 9-month penalty for interest, so she can definitely earn more than the cost of the interest. And the great thing about that is if this is a significant amount of money for them, all they need to do to keep their car and keep things going is just make that relatively small payment, and they can use the cash for other more urgent needs. But it's very difficult to go back with a paid-for car and try to borrow against the title, especially at 1.9%.
Sounds good. Michelle in Madison is with us now. Hello, Michelle.
Hi. I have been a listener of your advice about mortgages and 30-year mortgages, and our family has a bit of a unique to me circumstance, and I would love to know what options to consider. I'm a two-mom family. We have two kids, 8.5 and 10, and we both have disabilities. I got caught in the middle of all the stuff going on at the Capitol and lost my job in May and don't know yet anything about Social Security, whether or not I'll be qualifying long term. But we've been fortunate to be in a situation where my partner has excellent job and benefits, and so we're a really lucky family that we were even able to continue doing some remodeling that we had started before I lost my job. And my question about the mortgage is, we have about 12 years left on a 15-year mortgage with a good interest rate. We'd refinanced low 4.2, something like that. And we got into a discussion about do we refinance again at a 15-year, looking at the trade-offs between and still pay at our current rate in order to save more money, and also still have a lower requirement on, you know, our monthly mortgage payment. And we kind of got into a discussion of how do we think about these priorities with the disability considerations thrown in there. You know, a year ago I wouldn't have thought I'd lost my job, and 3 years ago we wouldn't have had disability considerations. And so I find myself saying, okay, I'm not a 30-year mortgage. It doesn't have quite the same low interest rate, but if we, our plan is that we would still pay at the same rate to try to pay the same amount off, we wouldn't end up saving as much money because of the higher interest as we would at that new 15 year. But what do we, you know, but having
you've got all the right questions, and I love the fact that, like any cohabitating couple, you use the word discussion with air quotes. I could just tell. Discussion for cohabitating couples typically means stomping off and door slamming. So let me help you get a 30-year mortgage, and you've done a great service to all the other people listening, because this is why I tell people to get 30-year mortgages when they don't need the money, because bad things can happen in life that they didn't expect, even though they're smart and they do the right things and work hard. Get the 30-year mortgage now. Pay it off as slowly as possible. If you need to pay it off more quickly, you can. There's no prepayment generally penalty for doing that. And even if you take out a 30-year mortgage and make the payment that the 15-year would have required, you'll still be able to pay that thing off in about 15 and a half years. But if you don't have the excess money that the higher payment of the 15-year requires, then you'll be able to pay it off slowly, keep your house, and pay for all the other things in your life, especially with your kids. And so I highly implore you to run, don't walk, to your next credit union or bank and go get that 30-year mortgage for as much as they will lend to you, because you may not have the opportunity to borrow this much in the future.
Michelle, thanks for the call, and good luck to you and your family. Brian in Minocqua is with us now. Hello, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to say I'm a delivery driver, so let's all avoid breaking a hip.
Good advice, Brian.
I'll make my question quick. I'm in my early 30s. I've got a 401k that my company contributes up to 5%. And I'm curious, I know the market's volatile. I saw my balance drop quite a bit when the market went ouch. And I'm just wondering, is it a bad idea to, right now half of it's in the sale principal?
Brian, I'm sorry. We're
definitely.
Good.
I agree with it. Wait, what did he say? I get the notion. Brian wants to know, if he should use his 401k and how he should invest. And definitely get the match in your 401k. And yes, if you're in your 30s, you're not going to be able to tap that money without a penalty, Brian, probably in for another 20 years or so, if not more. So you have a lot of time. If you're really worried about it, ramp up your savings and then invest more conservatively. But I am not worried at all about you using more aggressive options. If your company has what's known as a target date fund option, where it says, hey, this is the so-and-so lifestyle 2050 fund, say, use that, because that'll automatically start out more aggressively and then become more conservative as retirement approaches. It doesn't mean you can't lose money. It doesn't mean that it doesn't go down in value, but at least it takes, again, some of the decision-making out of your process. But save as aggressively into that as you can, if only for the tax breaks. And then if you're worried about the fluctuation, stick it to something that's a little more conservative.
Brian, thanks for the call. Sorry, your cell phone was breaking up a little bit. Boy, Kevin, your hearing's not going at all as you age. So congratulations on hearing that. What is the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, we're going to try to get some help to people who are looking for gifts for people. And online, you can go to thinkgeek.com. If you enjoy this show, or can tolerate it at least, and you do not love thinkgeek.com, I will be shocked. So go to thinkgeek.com, see all the items they have there, and you will find a nifty little inexpensive gift for someone who has a sense of humor, or at least a sense of humor like yours and mine and ours. Yeah. ThinkGeek.com. We'll have that link up to onyourmoney.com later on today.
I'm intrigued. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And we'll talk to Kevin again next week, another edition of On Your Money. By the way, on Thanksgiving, it's a tradition, we will be welcoming in financial counselor Connie Kilmark on Thanksgiving Day at 8 o'clock to talk about the best gifts we've ever given or received. That's Connie Kilmark on Thanksgiving this Thursday from 8 until 9. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.